This is part two of a three-part podcast.
Okay, we're back. We took like a little five-minute break, and I'm going to move us on to the next thingamabob that is on our list of thingamabobs that got munged by a previous recording. So this is where you expounded on the phrase, community is the longest, most expensive personal growth workshop you will ever take.
Yes, that's a phrase created in the middle 1990s by Zev Pace, who was an early activist in the co-housing movement in Colorado, where he and I both lived. He lived in the Boulder area. I lived in Fort Collins. I would come down to Boulder to attend various conferences that Zev would create. He started the Rocky Mountain Co-Housing Association, which later became the national organization, now called Co-Housing Association of the U.S. Anyway, Zev made that wonderful phrase, and it was so good that I quote him everywhere I go. I think that when you join an intentional community and or when you found one and end up living in one, you are experiencing more opportunities to learn about yourself, both the beneficial qualities that you have that you can go, oh, hey, I'm good at that, how great, and some negative qualities that you find out about that you go, oh, damn, I do that, rats, and then you get a chance to do some course correction. You learn so much about human nature, similar to what you said a little earlier, Paul, that with Code Ranch and Java Ranch, you were exposed to thousands of people and varieties of human nature you might not ordinarily have been exposed to. You learn so much, and it is a personal growth workshop, as it were. It's longer than a weekend. It goes on for years and years. It's extremely expensive if you're putting your life savings into co-purchasing the land and so on, and you learn a whole lot. I'd say it's a consciousness raiser, spiritual evolution booster, a course correction enhancer, and personality excess trimmer par excellence.
So now, I think one of the things when we talk about this, the part that was erased, is that there seem to be some people who will join community just for their personal growth. Like, oh, I recognize that, you know, I'm a broken person and I want to heal, and so I'm going to go and immerse myself in other human beings in the hopes that, you know, through all the pain that everybody experiences, that I will grow.
You know what, Paul? I don't think it's quite like that, although I think the way you're putting it is kind of funny, and maybe you're being ironic for purposes of humor.
I think that there are some people that are like that. I don't. I think it's the exception, not the rule.
Well, wait. I don't think there's somebody who says, I'm broken and I'm going to join a community because through other people's suffering I will grow. The person who is, quote, broken, and I'm going to put that in another way, experiencing some unhealed trauma and some personality distress and emotional distress as a result. First of all, they don't know this. They do not know this. I'm going to say that a third time. They have no idea. What they know is the world out there is full of assholes. Those people act like that, and those people over there act like that, and those people over there act like that, and those people over there have got it in for me, and those people over there are trying to victimize me. But do they know that they've got unhealed trauma and emotional distress that's very high and very touchy and reactive? No, they don't know it. They're the last to know. They might find out if they are willing to listen to the feedback that they get in community. But if they're too distressed, they won't listen to the feedback. They'll just assume there's something wrong with you. You're trying to victimize me. And they may create feuds and civil wars and Hatfield and McCoy type, I will never speak to you again feuds. Or they might leave the community, but they may not ever heal and grow, not as a result of any feedback they get. Other people who may be less traumatized, who may have lesser amounts of personal distress, I don't mean just sometimes, but I mean all the time, they might be willing to listen to feedback and to say, oh, maybe I'm doing something that turns people off. What could it be? Let me take a look. Let me get some outside healing help in the form of psychotherapy or spiritual healing or life coaching or some such outside help. Maybe I should do trauma release exercises or EFT tapping or something that will help me bring myself back into balance. Those people are really lucky because they can really benefit from being in community. But do they know going into the community that they've got stuff going on? Probably not. Probably their experience of reality is that other people are doing things wrong, damn them.
So now, at the Green Lake place where, you know, in the community that we were doing there, we did have people who came and asked to be part of the community, and as part of it, they were they felt that it was a great thing for their rehab. They were they wanted. I mean, these people we declined, but pretty much it was something where it was like they had a drug problem or an alcohol problem, or they had a problem where they were in jail. And they felt that being part of community was part of what would cure them. So I think that there are people where they, you know, they're owning their shit from the past, and they're, you know, trying to find a path that's going to be a cure. I don't think it's, and I think what you're saying is also true, and that there's a lot of people where they don't know that there's a problem.
Well, you know what, Paul?
What?
A drug addiction or an alcohol addiction or being in jail are things that you can't deny. I mean, you can deny them, but after a while you might notice that you're in the drunk tank or that you're in a drug treatment program or that you're in jail and there's some bars and you can't get out, in which case then you know. But I really wasn't talking about that, and I didn't realize you were. By the way, I'm really glad you all said no thank you to these folks, because community doesn't cure addictions or tendencies to go to jail. But what I was talking about is emotional distress, or to put it in common language, high amounts of touchiness or neuroses. Those are the people who don't know they've got it, because they're innocent. They don't know.
All I'm suggesting is that some people seek community for the healing effect on their person.
Some people seek community because they think it'll finally be the place that will be a haven for them, that they'll finally feel safe, that they'll finally be seen and heard, that they'll finally be loved, that they'll finally be included. They might not even consciously know that they're craving this and expecting it. But when they get into the community, they may find that their expectations are met or not met to various degrees, and then they'll be mad at the community because it's not providing what they expected on some conscious or subconscious level for the community to provide. And community doesn't provide that stuff. It gives you an opportunity to learn and grow if you want to.
So I'm not sure if I've shared this on a podcast before, but when it was in 2005 is a big year for me, meeting you, and it's also the year I took my PDC. So in January, I took my PDC, and so I lived with all these people for 14 days, and what happened is that I enjoyed it so much that my thinking while I was there was, how do I live like this the rest of my life? And so then that was my personal motivation in the community. It was shortly after that I ended up going away from the farm, the property that I had at the time, out of Mount Spokane, and then my first thought was like, okay, I realize that I want to be part of a community where we're doing awesome permaculture stuff all the time, and I've done all this stuff with ponds, but I kind of feel like, you know, on so much of this stuff I'm running point, and I'm the guy that's pushing it into existence. And I wish to be part of a community where there's like 20 different people who each have an aspect that they push forward into permaculture awesomeness. And I'm not the lead guy. I am a guy. And so then how do I get that? But at the same time, people that, you know, typically take up the space, and this is, I'm drawing on my knowledge from my history of working as a software engineer, you know, tend to be very strong-willed. I remember Mike Ayler was describing it once as, you know, how can you have two lions ruling at the same time? And that's kind of what your books help to help people to figure out. And so I'm trying to solve this the problems, but I'm recognizing that I wish to spend the rest of my life living in community, and not just any community. And it comes back to the communities being the longest, most expensive personal growth workshop you'll ever take. But it's like there are some people out there that I've encountered where it's like they really need community because they need to be cared for. They need somebody to be their rock. But I've also kind of encountered people where it's like I call them tar babies. It's like if you're around them, they will consume your life.
Yes.
You'll get covered in tar, and there's nothing else you're allowed to do with the rest of your life other than them.
Yes.
And so I kind of feel like, well, for the community that I seek, I wish for to not have tar babies. But at the same time, I wish for it to be the most personal growth workshop I will ever take, because there's these other 19 or 20 people that are all great leaders in permaculture, and we all live on this land together, and we're helping each other move forward.
Uh-huh.
And so I want it. And then at the same time, I want my flavor of it.
Well, you have the right to ask that, and also, there's this interesting dilemma or dichotomy or something here, where there are always people in any workshop that I do or in a conference where I'm a speaker that will say, "Oh, well, wait a sec, you shouldn't have a membership process in your community because it might screen out the people who really need it, like people who have great emotional difficulties or people who have, now let's go back to your original analogy, a drug problem or an alcohol problem, and they really need community to help them heal." That's what some people will say. And I say, please, I get on my knees and beg you to not say yes to these folks. Rather, if you want to be of service to them, be as kind and courteous and helpful as you can and help them find the appropriate agencies or therapies or professionals that can help them with their whatever it is. But don't say yes to having them in your community, because they will take every last ounce of energy that you've got. Your whole community will be exhausted and drained dealing with their issues, and that's not what your community's for, unless that is what your community's for. And you're specifically hoping to be a place that nurtures people with this particular kind of challenge or that particular kind of problem, in which case, if that's what you're doing and you have the money and the time and the expertise and the staff on staff to help them and deal with it, then by all means, do that. But otherwise, don't. And then people say, what are you? Are you cruel and are you heartless? And they'll quite believe that I am, because they'll think, how can you say that? The world needs community. And then they will shake their finger at me, theoretically, or maybe with their actual finger, and they'll say, you know, community has to reflect mainstream culture. I mean, in real life, we're not all perfect or anything. So, like, where are these people going to go? And they're indignant. I mean, can you imagine? They're kind of on their little soapbox, and they're scowling at me like, where are they going to go? They need community, too. And I'll say, listen, folks, I'm not here to try to resolve the many, many problems we have in this world, and we certainly do have many, and they all need resolving, and I don't doubt that. And I certainly do want people who have difficulties to have a good life and to be healed and to be accepted and welcomed and so on. And I say, but I'm just doing this one thing. I'm sharing with you what works well in communities from all the research I've done with real communities in real life around the world that really did get started and are successful, as compared to those that failed miserably with conflict, heartbreak, and lawsuits. So I'm just here to tell you what works. Please don't say yes to people who have great difficulties because you don't have the resources of person power, professional background and expertise and money to take care of them when you're also trying to create a community. Creating a community is hard enough because their zoning laws don't support it. It's financially difficult, especially if increasingly as the price of land goes up relative to people's disposable income. And so starting a community at all is hard enough. Please just do that. If one day when your land is paid off and all your buildings are built and you have plenty of cash in the bank, if you do, and you want to suddenly take on a project of helping people in distress and you have professionals on board who are going to do it and you can do it, then by all means do, but not till then, okay? Otherwise, somebody with great difficulties will swamp you. And then somebody will go, yes, but where is it going to go? And then I say, I don't know. Maybe you personally could assist them to find the right government agency or the right private agency or nonprofit that assists people with that. If this is your mission, then by all means do it. But if it's not the community's mission, then please don't ask me where they're going to go. And by the way, then I say, what makes you think that an intentional community is supposed to reflect the range of people in the wider population? Where did you get that idea? Is that a basic assumption that you're making? And they'll go, well, yeah. And I'll say, well, I don't think it's true. Your community is there to do what it's there to do. What we're supposed to do here in this workshop or in this talk or whatever it is to help the community have the best possible chance of succeeding to do the goal that it has, to do the purpose that it has. It's not necessarily supposed to reflect the wide variety of different kinds of people in the culture, unless that's precisely what you're about, in which case you're going to need a whole lot of money to hire the staff to deal with the people who will take a whole lot of time because of their great, huge challenges and difficulties. Well, this makes me real unpopular with certain people who are really at the top of that chart we talked about last time.
Yeah, and there's many flavors of people at the top of that chart. And when I encounter those people when I'm out speaking or whatever, and uh-huh. they say exactly that thing, you know, are uh-huh, you some uh-huh. kind of meanie because you're not, you know, bringing these people in who need your help?
Right.
And then my response is by your standards, yes, I am the asshole king. I am the meanest person in the world by your standards, and I'm grateful that there are so many different people in community with so many different standards that there are places where it's like they want to bring in those who need to be in community, much like you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that for me personally, I have a different set of goals, and bringing those people in does not further my goals. In fact, it hinders my goals. So I'm dedicating my life to my goals, and I appreciate that you're dedicating your life to your goals.
Yeah.
Actually, you would not want to have me enter into some kind of contract of a lifetime of slavery to force me to live my life according to your standards.
Uh-huh.
And of course, then I can go on to a rant for 3 hours about how so many people seem to really, really, really need, like 95% of the population really needs other people to live life in a way different than they're living, although they don't follow that path themselves. So I've gotten thousands, literally thousands of people telling me that I live my life in an inappropriate fashion, but it turns out the path that they want me to live is not the path that they're living themselves. So it's a weird human element. And so then as we're trying, I mean, basically this is what you and I are trying really, really hard to do. How do you get these people who are so human to live that close together, or help to come together to make decisions, or whatever, to be able to get along, and that's really the challenge of all of this topic of intentional community, having these people get along.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, you know what? Governance of decision making is at the heart of all of it. You know how I said before, you need these three things: effective project management, and good community glue, and good process and communication skills. The foundational thing for all of that is, how do you govern yourselves, and with which decision-making method do you make decisions? Governance is what are we deciding about, and decision-making is how do we make those decisions. That can make or break a group, in my opinion. Of course, once again, there's no one thing that makes or breaks a group, so I really shouldn't say that, but it is so basic and foundational. So when I see groups struggling, I say, well, what's your governance and decision-making method? And when I find out what it is, or what vague, meandering thing it is with different people not agreeing on what it is, et cetera, I can see right where the healing needs to start, you know?
I think that there are people out there that need to enter into a relationship with a tar baby. That's their function in life, is to be... And there are people, I've met these people that just have like infinite love, infinite caring, and they can take on three or four tar babies at once.
So when you say tar baby, you mean a person who has a lot of emotional distress and is challenged in life, right? And tar baby meaning they'll take up a lot of your time, even if they're not trying to or they don't mean to. But they do take up a lot of time and energy.
I would say sometimes a tar baby is made out of tar, and sometimes a tar baby is made out of something other, something like tree sap or something. So what's the contents of the tar doesn't really matter. What happens is that if you engage a tar baby, you could find yourself stuck for life. And no way to get away from the tar. You will never disengage the tar baby. And so I think that the moment that you think you've categorized all the possible different kinds of tar babies, you'll find out what kind of comedian God really is and bring you a whole new flavor. And so I think that it's safe to say that there are tar babies out there. Somebody who will just, you know, through one thing or another, through some flavor, they will just latch on and you'll have a really difficult time disengaging.
Well, if this is in the context of an intentional community like Eco Village or co-housing or a shared group household like you have been describing,
yes,
there's the membership process at the beginning where you want to find out if this person who's coming into your community or who would like to is a potential, and I'm not going to call them a tar baby, I'm going to say a person with a lot of emotional distress and who will take up a lot of time. The thing to do is to say, no, thank you, not at this time, at the membership level, you know, at the get-go. But let's say that they're already in there for some reason, like they were one of the founders, that happens. And then there are things a group can do to induce them to please listen to the feedback or to become so exhausted and demoralized by receiving feedback that they either decide to go get some helpful, needed outside help, such as therapy, or they decide that they're going to they're going to leave the community, in either case of which the community benefits.
So I think that in most cases, yes, it's absolutely true that it's wise to avoid people that are not a fit, people that are going to need a lot of time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they're not even trying
to take up a lot of time.
Oh, yeah. They're not
trying.
They
just do because they're yeah. getting so upset so often over so little. And then in the business meeting, the facilitator and the other folks think they need to deal with it or they don't know how to deal with it or the whole meeting goes cuckoo. And it's such a shame for everyone.
So, and at the same time, I guess all I was trying to say is much like the person who's asking you this question, there are people out there where it's their mission in life to help in that way, and more power to them. I am so glad that those people are out there doing so much to help those people that need that kind of help.
And that's right.
It is something where it's just their calling. They just wish to help, you know, one or two or three people who really, really need a lot of that kind of help. But I think that most community is not looking to be that helpful person.
Let's take the two kinds of things that can happen, okay? One is the community is not set up specifically to be of service to people in distress. They have some other role, such as our mission is to experiment with permaculture design to see how much yield we can get with how little labor and to share that information with others. That sounds like your community. And then there's my community. How can we learn as much as we can about sustainable economics and sustainable site plan design and ecological living and social of sustainability that as we're learning it, we can teach others through classes and workshops in a classic eco-village setting. That would be my community. Okay, but let's say that the community is specifically designed to assist people in need. That would be fine. But if they're not, and people who have a lot of need for time and attention and emotional healing therapy and so on want to join, the community has to say to itself, are we willing to spend the time this person is going to take? Or will the time this person's going to take in meetings, in mediations, in attempting to have whole group heart shares to work with this person's issues and the disruption that they trigger in the group, are we willing to do that? Or do we want to say, hey, listen, would you be willing to live nearby and come over and visit with us and be part of a social scene but not actually be a member? Because we're saying, no, thank you, but it doesn't mean you can't come over for dinner. And so, you know, there's ways to do it. But let's say that you've got a person like that in the community already. There's things that you can do. One thing that I know of, I call the mini raindrops makes a flood method. And if you're interested, I can tell you about it. And if not, I can send a handout about it to people listening to this podcast if they'll email me. Or both.
So I'm going to say that I would like to hear about the mini raindrops make a flood right now.
Okay, here it is. This is a method that a group can consciously use to induce a challenging member to either get outside healing help or leave. And the way it works sort of like the permaculture principle of if you're designing a landscape, you go along with the way Mother Nature actually works, the way aspect and sunlight and gravity and so on all already works anyway. So this is a human nature design. It's designed to go along with the way human nature works anyway. So here's the deal. The people who are feeling concerned and sad and exhausted and demoralized and frustrated by this person's persistent, consistent behavior that is challenging, get together and say to themselves that they will give this person gentle, courteous feedback each and every time the person does one of those things, does or says one of those things that are the things that they do. It could be as gentle as, "Oh, excuse me, Reginald, would you please not do that?" "Oh, excuse me, Reginald, would you please not say that like that," but rather say it in a more courteous way, like this or something. That's gentle. It's like a raindrop. A little tiny raindrop is so gentle that it falls upon your hand or your arm and you think, "Oh, yes, a raindrop. It doesn't hurt. It's just a little drop." However, if the person gets lots of feedback from lots of people each and every time they do it, it's a kind of negative reinforcement of that behavior. Not negative in a mean, bad way, like getting stung by a bee or being slapped with something that hurts. A gentle raindrop is only a gentle raindrop. "Oh, excuse me, Reginald, could you please not speak to me that way?" Or whatever it is, okay? So gentle raindrops to you or me would probably be gentle raindrops. We might say, "Oh, really? Do I do that? Oh, I'm doing that again? Oh, damn, I'm sorry. Well, tell me that. When did I do that again?" We might be curious and interested because we might be interested in some course correction. At least I am. Painful though it is, I do listen to feedback because here I am in community, which is my long, expensive personal growth workshop. But a person who has a high amount of emotional distress is a little bit different from other folks because a gentle raindrop doesn't feel like a gentle raindrop. It feels terrible. Even if it's a courteous request like, "Oh, excuse me, Reginald, would you please not speak to me like that right now? Could you please talk more like this?" Oh, in a courteous way, like for example this. I, Reginald, will experience this as a terrible, painful thing. I will think that I'm being victimized by you. I might say, "Well, how dare you say that to me?" I might say, "Well, you're picking on me." If multiple people are asking me, now I'm going to say me, Diana, not Reginald, if multiple people are saying to me, "Diana, could you please not," and then they name some fault that I have that I do kind of consistently and compulsively, I'm going to realize I have that fault. I'm going to realize I do that thing. Unless I'm incapable of realizing, in which case I'm going to say, "I'm not putting up with this shit anymore, and I'm going to pack my bags and leave the community." Now, why did I use that phrase? Because the way I discovered the mini raindrops makes a flood method is because of observing it in three different communities with people that got a lot of feedback, spontaneous, unrehearsed, and undecided, but they got a lot of feedback from a lot of people. And each of them said, quote, "I'm not putting up with this shit anymore," unquote, and left. They used the same phrase. What they were saying is, "I'm not putting up with how bad I feel as a result of these people making these requests of me, so I'm leaving." But what they experienced it was, is that, "You all are doing something bad to me, I'm out of here." But look at what they could have done, because they have an option, right? What they could have done is said, "Oh, I guess maybe," community being the great feedback place where I'm having a long and expensive personal growth workshop, "I could listen to this feedback. I could be paying a counselor or a psychotherapist or a psychiatrist or a life coach, you know, thousands of dollars to get feedback about myself, or I could listen to the people in community. Other than my joining fee and my dues and fees that I pay here, their feedback is free." And so it's painful but free. So you could listen to it and you could transform yourself by getting outside healing help if you had the cojones to do that, in which case the community benefits and you've benefited and the feedback has been beneficial for your whole life growth, right? Or you could say, "I'm not putting up with this shit anymore," quote unquote, pack your bags and leave, in which case the community benefits. And who's to know that sometime in the future you don't actually find that feedback useful and then you benefit too, or not. So why do I call it mini raindrops makes a flood? Because they're gentle, courteous requests, and the effect on the person is cumulative and like a flood.
So the one thing, as you're saying that, which I agree with, I think that, my favorite part was where you qualified it to say that it's assuming that it's something that person is willing to grow with. Like they're open to it. Although some of the things you said were like, you know, no, it's more spontaneous. And I was thinking like, because I think about how many little raindrops have come and landed upon me where people would say, could you please not use that sort of language around me?
Mm-hmm.
And then my response is, could you please try to not shame me into living a small, pathetic life like yours? And so I kind of feel
Wait a minute. Can we back up a sec?
Okay.
I'm curious because you've caught my interest by what you just said.
Yes.
Let's say that you are using language which I find offensive, but that you don't find offensive and that you like to use. And so we have different cultures of expectation about language.
Sure.
Nobody's wrong. Nobody's right. It's just that you like to say, like I said, piss, poor, and shit in this radio interview. And maybe some people go, oh, how unladylike. And baby's so right. And I'm not ladylike.
No, they're cool with it in this podcast, or they could switch to a different podcast.
Well, the point is, you see, I have a language culture that I'm in, and you have one, and different ones of us have different ones, okay? All righty. So when somebody gives a person feedback in a courteous way saying, would you please not use language like that around me, the person could either say, okay, I'll try to remember, remind me again, I might forget. Or they might say, no, I'm going to talk this way, so you'll have to deal with it. But to say, I'm so glad I don't have a pathetic little life like yours, seems like overkill. It seems like here I am going to put you down, make you wrong, and try to humiliate you in front of all these people by saying you have a pathetic little life because you have a different language culture than I have. So it's like, hey, Paul, don't do that. I'm going to give you a raindrop right now, okay? Hey, please don't do that.
No. I'm going to go ahead and do that. And because here's what
I'd
say.
Why put them down and make them wrong? Why not just say no? No, I'm going to keep talking like this. This is how I talk. I'm sorry you don't like it, but I'm not going to change.
Part of it is that I have humor needs, and part of it is going to be because I do believe it's a horribly inappropriate thing to ask somebody to live their life according to your standards, and it's like this person is this person being me. I am speaking in a manner that I enjoy. I enjoy the poetry of it, and in fact. I find that the reason why people become offended over a lot of the words, I mean, there are certain words that I find offensive myself. And I do try to say something and be polite about it. But I try to also phrase it in such a way that it pains me as opposed to like, hey, can you change the way you behave so that way I can tolerate being around you? And I kind of feel like, and it's come up a few times when I'm making public presentations, and I love it when I go to give a presentation, and then the billing is something about don't bring your children. Adult language will be used, and it's going to be about gardening. And usually when they do that, that's when the place is packed. Oh, adult language about gardening. Wow, how could that be? So, but then there's been places where they didn't say anything, and then there's children in the audience, and so I start off by saying, Uncle Paul's going to teach you some new words today. And it's like, okay, parents, you've been warned. You can get your kids out of here now, or else it's going to be. And then there is once in a while, it hasn't been in a long time, but there was, a long time ago, people would say, oh, do you really have to use that language for this presentation? And I kind of feel like, you know what, I'm a bit of a poet. And this is the poetry, this is the prose I've elected to use, and I do find beauty in it. And I think that people that have trained themselves to be offended at the word fuck, for example, that the training is unfounded. The training has everything to do with shaming others.
Wait a minute, hold on. Gosh, I got to talk to you about this. You've got a choice other than resorting to shaming, humiliating, and putting somebody down by saying they have a pathetic little life. Your choice is to say, no, I'm not going to change my language. I'm going to keep on talking like this. That is simple. It's straightforward. It's true. It's not you bullshitting. It's you. See, I said bullshitting. It's not you bullshitting. It's you being real. But you don't have to make them wrong, for God's sakes, Paul. Why? That's overkill. That's cutting butter with a chainsaw. You only need a butter knife.
So we all have our paths, which we choose to follow. And I guess some people are seeking a path which is a normalized path. How can I be as agreeable as possible? And there is value to that path. And then there is a path where it's like, I'm not seeking that. I am hell-bent on finding a new path, what I believe to be a better path. And I'm going to, in fact, you know, we've got a great thread out of Permies that's called the F word. And I think it's a good couple of pages long.
Uh-huh.
And then when people make the argument of like, so many people have come to me, like, you know, I'm going to say about 500 or so. You'll be able to reach more people if you choose a language set that doesn't include the word fuck. And I disagree. And then of course they present this as fact. This is a fact. If you change your language set to not include the word fuck, if you leave out the language that we have labeled as profane, you will reach more people. And then my position is like, who reaches more people, Brian Williams or Robin Williams? Now Brian Williams is going to come onto the news every day, and he's going to tell you the news. And that's his job. His job is to be a talking head.
We're arguing it at cross purposes here, because I have no quarrel with or knowledge about the statistics about who you do or don't reach depending on talking. Yeah. I'm talking about you having as a value be nice, and you having as a value that you would like the world to be a better place.
Yes.
And you having as a value that you're not just doing permaculture design, you're also doing community design, which is having to do with human beings and how they do and don't communicate with each other. And you have told me that communication screw-ups is one of the big things that goes on, and that you don't much like it and you like things to be better. So what I'm trying to do is take what I think are your values and your interests, given what you've told me, and say that you don't have to be punitive to somebody who sees the world differently than you. You can simply be informative. No, I'm going to keep talking the way I do. I like to use these words, then you could say the words, and I'm going to keep using them in this talk. So please know that now. I'll continue, and then you move on. To put them down and make them wrong seems like it violates your own be nice code.
So everything you've said is true except for the part where you said, this violates my be nice code. Because, of course, the be nice code that I project.
No, I'm not talking about using the language. Please say any words you like to, including to me, including on the air here. I'm talking about putting the person down who makes the
decision. I'm getting to that. Getting to that, but Diana...
Yeah.
You've got to not interrupt me.
Okay.
And then I will answer your question.
Okay, I apologize.
Okay. So the thing is that this is be nice based upon my standards of what are nice. And then and combine that with the whole idea of, like, I'm standing in front of a room and somebody decides that this is a time to say, much like the language you just used. You just used the language saying, you don't have to say that. Oh, that's true. I don't have to say that.
Mm-hmm.
You're absolutely correct. And at the same time, I have my reasons on why I choose to say that. And as I was attempting to discuss earlier, I think we have a beautiful thread. And there's the whole thing about, you know, who reaches more people, Brian Williams versus Robin Williams. That's in response to a point that somebody's trying to make about if you will reach more people. It is presented as a fact. So what I'm encountering is that I believe that there is a serious problem. And at the very beginning of my keynote that I did at Permaculture Voices, I started off with this. I started off with the idea of children dying of starvation. And then I said something about son of a bitch. And then I point out that some people would get more offended by me saying son of a bitch than by the point where I said children dying of starvation. And I kind of feel like the values there are really screwed up. And I feel like this problem is getting way out of hand, where people are being so upset over language, which I believe is an entirely artificial thing to be upset about. It's a red herring. There are so many real things to be upset about.
That's not what I'm talking to you about. I'm talking to you about your choice to make someone wrong and put them down right then and there. They have a miserable little life. What a petty thing to stoop to. You don't have to do that. My God, you're bigger than that, aren't you?
That's what I'm saying, is I'm living a large and glorious life.
You can say anything you want, but why put somebody down? Why do it? How can it possibly help them or anybody listening to you? There's no redeeming value in humiliating and manipulating somebody. You have said to me that you don't like manipulation in conversations. And when you say to somebody who makes a request that you're not willing to comply with and that you believe should not have asked you that, why don't you go ahead and think they shouldn't ask you, keep using the language you like, and just tell them no, and not try to point out to the whole room and the whole conference that they have a miserable little life. That is a manipulation.
It is not a manipulation. And so now you are correct.
Manipulate them into feeling shame.
Now the manipulation thing is your word, not mine. And the thing that we talked about before we started recording was about accuracy in our statements. And so you and I both agree that we wish to be more accurate in the way that we speak, and that we encouraged each other to help each other become more accurate. It's something where we both wish to grow. We wish to, if we ever say anything that's less than accurate, we wish to be corrected. And so, but now your word was manipulation, and I'm not signing up with that one. Now, at the same time, I've got two different websites for permaculture. I've got one that's richsoil.com, and I've got one that's permies.com. And so at permies.com, I have a different set of values for which I speak myself, and it's the same set of values that I require of everybody. And this is this be nice thing, and you don't get a chance to vent. However, when I'm recording a podcast, which will be, you know, put out at richsoil.com, and anything that I write at richsoil.com, these are my opinions. I'm going, and my function is that I wish to share my opinions, knowing that my opinions and my position will be horribly offensive to those people who choose to be offended by such things. And then on top of that, okay, so I'm going to set those two things aside. I've got, when I am presenting, I'm going to present based on the Rich Soil rules of how I live my life, not on the permies.com rules for where I try to nurture a type of community. So when I'm presenting, it is this kind of presentation. I really enjoyed when I was as a thing for Permaculture Voices. Diego had this special event where it's like three of the speakers came in. It was some kind of webinar-ish kind of a thing. And then as part of the webinar, he plays this audio thing saying, coming up next is Paul Wheaton. And then he had like a 1-minute thing that was a bunch of clips of a presentation I'd given earlier, like a year earlier.
Uh-huh.
And part of that I said, fuck that shit. And then one of the comments that came up is like, I sure hope that the presentation we're going to have does not include that kind of language. And mm-hmm. Diego said, I'm going to give you your money back. You're going to want to leave right now because it will contain that kind of language.
Well, he was honest and direct and straightforward.
Yes.
And so are you. Here's my point, Paul. And then I think we should move on to other topics because I think we're taking up people's time with this disagreement of opinion that we have, but that is, if you want to have a community that functions well, and somebody who is wanting to join or already lives there says, Paul, I would appreciate it if you didn't use that language, and they were being all prissy about it, or if they were just being straightforward and said, hey, could you please not say that in my presence? If you say, I'm sure glad I don't have to live a miserable little life like your miserable little life, you're going to create more disharmony in that community than if you just said, no, I'm going to keep talking like this. That's my only point.
So much like you said, how some people will get the raindrop, and then they'll feel terribly offended by it. As you were saying that, then this is what I was thinking of, this exact thing. And my reasoning is that while they might see it as a little raindrop, I see that statement to be extremely offensive.
To you personally?
To me, when somebody says, could you please not use that kind of language around me?
Uh-huh.
When they say, I find it extremely offensive.
So you feel triggered emotionally by it.
I feel triggered intellectually by it.
Okay, intellectually, and the emotion that goes along with it, I think, is frustration or annoyance or irritation or anger. You want to retaliate in, like a chainsaw instead of a butter knife. You're a miserable little wife. That's a big retaliation.
I've encountered it so many times.
Excuse me, that's my ear. Sorry about that.
I've encountered it so many times that I've come up with a path that is comfortable for me. And at the same time, I feel like it is an extremely offensive thing for somebody to say to me. And the thing is they don't even understand why. Why would it be offensive? It's in fact, they'll be offended at the idea that I might even possibly be offended. They might want to engage me further on this topic. But, you know, and then part of it is that I feel like what I want to do is, and especially if I'm giving a presentation and somebody decides to do this and throw and play this card, is I've got more important things to talk about than this. And so then, you know, after it coming up so many times, this is where I am now. When somebody says, when they think that they're doing a little raindrop, I just kind of feel like, wow, I just learned that you've been trained to be offended by something for which it's empty air. There's nothing behind it to be offended about other than simply, I choose to be offended. I choose to be upset about something that has no substance whatsoever.
And I'm wondering why that has a lot of emotional charge for you, because, to put it up bluntly, so fucking what?
But it's that dumb fucks wish to rule my life. Dumb fucks wish to pull my puppet strings. They believe I'm a puppet.
It's only a request. Say
get
no.
Your hand out of my ass. I'm not a puppet.
Why don't you say no?
And so, I don't have to have a reason to say no. But I'm sure that there are reasons why I could. I don't even wish to explore them. The key is what I want to do is I find it extremely offensive, and I want to shut it down. And I don't want to just simply walk away. I wish to drive home the point that this is, it's kind of like the whole idea about CFLs are environmentally friendly. I want to drive home the point that they are not. They're the opposite. They're an environmental disaster.
Okay, well, let's bring this discussion of our disagreeing on this point back to the purpose of this podcast, which is there's people listening. Yeah. There's people listening who are thinking, I'm listening to this because I'm kind of interested in what Paul and Diana have to say about intentional community. So let's you and I disagree. I mean, let's you and I agree to disagree on the point that in a community, when you give a chainsaw to cut butter instead of a knife, like your miserable little life, instead of just saying, no, I'm not following that request, and by the way, I disagree with you even asking it. Well, you know, like, I think that's not a good idea. You think it is a good idea, so we disagree. We should probably say, yep, we disagree. It's okay with us that we do, and talk about the next topic on the list.
Okay.
What do you think?
I think it's important to say that, you know, it's a very good idea to bring together people in community that share a value set.
Yes.
And if at one community their value set is to fear certain words fear certain empty words, we've just decided, me, oh, don't say that.
Like you know, knights of me.
Bring me a shrubbery. And so
yes,
it's like, you know, there's words that we've decided we can't.
Okay, so here's what you do. Bringing it back to the topic, okay? In our community, whichever one we're talking about, in this case yours, we use these words, and I, Paul, do not want you to give me any grief about it, or I will say the following thing to you right then and there. Okay, I'm agreeing to join your community knowing that that's the agreement. Sure, fine. Say anything you like. I realize it's an empty concept and I'm not going to go get offended. Or if I am offended, I'll keep it to myself on account of I'd love to be here with you. Okay?
Fine.
That's one thing. Secondly, let's say that the community has a value called we don't swear. I know a community like that, that they have this agreement not to use certain words. And so which is fine with me. Both is fine with me, actually. And so the thing is, let's just make it clear so that we don't fool people into not knowing. You know, like, let's make it clear from the get-go. Like you said a while back, clarity at the outset.
I think there's, I mean, I'm trying to solve what I believe are world problems. And when and recently there was a film crew here, and they were asking me, like, well, what's your mission with this farm?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, the mission is that it's not a farm. and so I basically said the mission has to do with things like curing cancer, reducing war, reducing pollution, reducing sickness in general. These are our goals. We believe that we're doing things in this major epic thing, and we've got things to discover and learn. But then when you're trying to solve the world's problems, then so many people are currently chasing after red herrings. It's like 80% of the effort being put to solving world problems is on what I believe are red herrings. And so I am very concerned about red herrings, which is why I ended up being the light bulb guy. I really don't give a damn about light bulbs, but so many people, when I try to talk about a hugel culture bed, are like, oh, I don't need to hear about that because I've already bought the light bulbs. I'm already doing my part for the environment. I bought the light bulbs. And so then next thing you know, I need to prove to everybody, like, okay, these light bulbs that you're so keen on are shit. They are an environmental disaster with greenwashing. And so then I go to each one of these things where people are like, oh, no, children having cancer, children dying of starvation, whatever. But you said the word fuck. Oh, now I've got to stand up out of my chair, and I need to say, could you please not use that? Or the other one, that's much like what you just said a little bit ago.
I would appreciate it if you would not.
Do you really have to say that?
Okay. All right. Let's do this. Let's go to the next topic.
Okay. Fair enough.
Okay.
This is the last two pieces are actually one piece, one and the same.
Okay.
And so basically, in the part that got lost, I talked about founder syndrome, and then you came back, and it's the second piece, is that mm-hmm. you said there's two kinds of founder syndrome.
I would say, yeah.
Yeah, and so I started off with the one kind, you know, the when I say founder syndrome, I think of a thing. And this is a thing that I've heard the story many, many times, and I think I have visited with, I believe, three different people for whom this has happened.
Mm-hmm.
And you were saying, prove it, and I did. I said, did you talk to Morgan Markowitz?
Have I talked to Morgan? No. For those listening, we both know a guy named Morgan, and his dad, was it his dad?
It's his dad, Franklin.
Experienced some awful stuff.
Founder's syndrome. The founder syndrome that's in my head.
Why don't you define the founder's syndrome in the way that's one of the two ways that I think there's two ways so that people know what you're talking about.
So founder's syndrome is where somebody will go out and they will start a community. And then next thing you know, there's like 20 people, you know, there. And then the people that are there are kind of like, oh, you know, this place is a beautiful, wonderful place. I love, love, love living here. This is the best thing I've ever done in my life, which would be slightly better if we could just get rid of that guy that is so type A. He is always talking about taxes. He's always talking about, you know, building roads. And he's always talking about all of these things that are a real downer. And I think that our community would be better if we just didn't have that guy. Well, that guy.
So they kick him out.
And so then they kick him out, and it's the founder. And it's like, so basically, it's you know, the founder syndrome is, it takes a certain kind of person to start a community. And it's a lot of hard work. And then there's going to be, you know, lots of topics involved that most people don't want to know about. It's going to be like, you know, legal stuff with the local governments and the bigger governments.
Can I stop you for a minute?
Okay.
Okay. I think you're making a good point, and I think that your point is heard by the listeners. I used to be a radio interviewer and a radio moderator, so I kind of have the sense of when you've made a point that it's verbally and visually enough. So I'm thinking you made your point. However, I think that you would be teaching people that what you're calling founder syndrome is when a founder gets kicked out. When I wrote about the two kind of founder syndromes in my book, I was talking about two different things. One is when you blame the founder for real things the founder really is doing that are annoying and difficult, because the founder really is doing things that are difficult. So you criticize the founder, and rightly so. You try to give the founder some feedback, like, hey, Reginald, each time you say and do this, it seems to have a negative effect on the group. Let me tell you why. Could you consider not doing this? Or you get into a discussion about it. That's founder syndrome, where the founder is getting called on his or her real stuff he or she really does do. Founder syndrome, too, is when the founder isn't doing anything in particular except, you know, existing, and people are projecting onto the founder that, who do you think you are? And making the founder wrong, because the people are unable to imagine being a person who is so empowered and confident and capable and able to take risks and make things happen, resenting that person because they think it implies that maybe they're not okay because they couldn't do that, then they go and make the founder wrong. One is about projection. One is about real and accurate feedback. And that's all I mean about founder syndrome. You see how it's quite different than what you're saying?
Right. There's two different things that have nothing to do with what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's a total of three. And so now...
So you're talking about when a founder is disliked by the people or dis-something by the people in their community and they're kicked out.
I'm saying that it happens a lot.
Right. So you're calling it founder syndrome, but it's a topic, and the topic is it happens. So here's what I'm going to say. That community is very badly designed. If communities are like permaculture landscapes, it's a bad design. It needs a better structure so that couldn't happen. Or so that if the person is kicked out, it's based on real issues that have been agreed on in advance. And paying the damn bills to keep the wolf from the door shouldn't be an issue for kicking somebody out. Failing to pay the bills might be. Do you see my point?
So I think that based on some of the things that you just said, because this is, in 2005, this was the issue for which I felt like I need to immerse myself in learning about intentional community if I'm going to go someplace and have it last. And I struggled because I kind of felt like, and then when I heard from Robina about founder syndrome, which is the one that I've got, I was so glad to hear her say it, because it's like that is one of the things I would be concerned about. And then just a moment ago you were saying something about like, okay, you know, the founder in this particular case, the founder is behaving in a way that the rest of the community is uncomfortable with. It's kind of like I can see myself being that guy, and my behavior is something that the rest of the community is being uncomfortable with. And at the same time, while, you know, that would be my fear, is like, okay, I came here to do permaculture things, and then the permaculture things that I do are things that the community is not comfortable with. And then they're kind of like, hey, could you just, like, not do that? And it's like, but that's why I'm here, is I need to do these things that are, I believe, are so important.
That's a design flaw in the design of the community structure.
And there you go. You could say it's a design flaw, and the community could be like, no, actually, our community structure is flawless and perfect.
No,
and if you want it to change, then you've got to go through the process to change it. But right now, for where it stands, your behavior is not acceptable.
No, Paul, I'm not saying that I'm telling those people who are saying that to the founder that you have a design flaw. I'm talking to you, Paul, here on this podcast. That community is poorly designed if those people have a leg to stand on saying, we don't like it that you're paying the bills and talking about legal things. We don't want that. What you've got is a piss-poor membership process.
So I mean, my concern in 2005 is that my behavior and the things that I need to do oftentimes are extremely offensive to nearly everyone until it's done. And when it's done, then it seems like all those same people who may have been all offended by what I was doing would then say, but of course, that's obvious that you would do that, and of course it's awesome.
So
during the construction phase, they're against it. But when it's all done, they're like, it's beautiful.
Listen, you've solved the problem that you were concerned about specifically by being the boss of the community, by being the buck stops here guy who decides things at the bottom line when they need deciding, and that is a way to do it that does work, and it's working for you, and it's working for your group, Wheaton Lab, there in Montana. Another way to do it is that the whole community uses good design principles for designing community to come up with checks and balances so this kind of crap can't happen.
Right.
So we have two different ways to solve it. Did you want to talk further about experiences of different people where the founder was kicked out?
I'm pretty sure that in older podcasts I've talked about founder syndrome. I think it's an important thing, and so I am surprised to learn that my understanding of what the phrase founder syndrome is not lined up with the two definitions, with either of the two definitions of what your understanding of founder syndrome is. So there's apparently three definitions floating around of founder syndrome.
Well, it sounds like Robina McCurdy was using a definition that she has, which is absolutely fine. And so now we could say, well, there's two that I put out into the world, and there's one that Robina puts out into the world, and that's the one that you cite when you use the phrase. And it's fine, you know, if we have these different ways we talk about it. Seems to me it's fine. I'm very sorry about Morgan's dad and any founder that gets kicked out of their own community, with the exception of those instances in which case the founder was doing egregiously bad things, which also has happened. Also.
Right.
So, in which case, well, I'm glad the group kicked out that founder.
So, in the case of Morgan's dad, he bought the land. And then there was a phase where it's like, okay, we're going to go into a consensus-based system, which means that there is this possibility that, you know, I could be kicked off of the land, and am I willing to take that risk? And he decided that these people were lovely and that he was willing to take that risk.
Well, wait a second, though. Their community was not well-designed because they didn't have a clear, well-agreed-upon set of reasons for kicking somebody off. That he himself had agreed to, which he realized that he would or wouldn't qualify to get kicked off for. Do you see what I'm saying?
This
is bad design.
Almost
everything that you have been citing that goes wrong in community, I can see is because the problem wasn't the behavior in the moment. The problem was that the poor folks didn't know how to design it better at the get-go.
Absolutely true. 100% correct. Hindsight 2020. And I'm going to go further to state that every community that exists today has a less than perfect system in place right now, and that they are going to need to continually evolve their system in order to strive towards perfection, but they will never get there.
That's right.
In this case, Morgan's dad was certain that he had a very good system, and it turns out that he did not.
That's right.
And in hindsight, he can see that, you can see that, I can see that.
Uh-huh.
We can all see, in hindsight, how the system was flawed.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, we were not consulted at the time that they were, you know, putting into place their systems that he would therefore later be judged by and then kicked out from the community.
So Paul, what we could say is that we both, and Morgan and Robina McCurdy, have been gathering data. You might say we've been observing the landscape in a slow, long, and thoughtful and protracted process in order to find out what works and what doesn't work when designing intentional communities. And we know some things that don't work because of the painful experiences of various folks that we both know, or that you've experienced, or that I've experienced, or that the many people I've done research with have reported to me, or that I've observed when I'm visiting their community.
Absolutely.
And so we're gathering data about what does and doesn't work.
Yes.
You are doing so about permaculture and intentional communities. I'm doing so about intentional communities solely. And I agree with you that most communities have more than one thing going on that's not too ideal, because maybe they haven't run into the problems with that thing yet, and or maybe their governance and decision-making system doesn't allow them to do course correction very easily. P.S. one of the reasons I like sociocracy so much as a governance and decision-making system is because it's so flexible. You can see how reality is giving you feedback and change things as needed. I love that because that's what communities need, as do well-designed permaculture landscapes, right? When something's going wrong in your landscape, alter the design, test it a little bit, see if this thing works better, and voila, you've got some data, right?
True. I mean, and that, and basically, I think that that's, you know, a big part of the your teachings is to help people avoid what Morgan's dad went through.
Yeah.
And I think at the same time that much, you know, in fact, I'm going to pick on you for just a second, but you know, okay. I don't mean to harm you in any way.
No, I know that. Go ahead.
And that is that time. Years ago you advocated consensus.
I did. I was wrong.
And so, and then you've moved on to other things. And I think the systems that are being put into place today are good, but they're still holes. And it's like, so to, you know, when we say they didn't have a very good system in place, then I think that that's going to be true for them, and it's true for all of them right now.
Well,
all of them have flaws.
I would say that you're right, and that we do not know. Let's, given our present knowledge, if we could combine your knowledge and my knowledge together, which would be a lot of knowledge about intentional communities and how they do and don't work well. And we could combine it, and we had this one big mind known as the Paul and Diana mind or database, you know, on all this stuff. There would be a whole lot that we know that does and doesn't work. But then there's all those things that we don't know yet, where there's no data that we've received yet. There's no, like, anecdotes and stories on how did you resolve it and did it work well or did it not work well, stuff we don't know. So probably this field that we're both so interested in, it will, and we will learn as we go along, what works even better than that, and what works even better than that, and what prevents that kind of problem, and what prevents it even better, you know, later in the future, we'll learn that other thing. So I think we're, basically this whole deal is a work in progress, you know?
You know, it just occurred to me just now, as we're talking about this, that possibly a book to augment this discussion, which might be an augment for your books, would be Animal Farm.
Oh, my God.
Four legs, good. Two legs, better. Hey, didn't that say bad yesterday? I don't know. I don't really even know how to read.
I actually think that I only know the rough outlines of the plot because I read 1984, but not that one. So at some point, I guess I better read it if you think it has some good analogies for community.
Well, and so basically the animals take over the farm, and then the pigs kind of, like, you know, take charge.
Uh-huh.
And so then they're like, that farmer was such an ass, and so we got rid of him, and so now it's just the animals. And so then the horse keeps taking on, and it's like I kind of feel like this has been my theme for the last 2 years, is the horse would constantly, so whenever there's a problem, the horse says, well, then I will work harder. And then the horse works harder, and then finally the horse, you know, works too hard and hurts himself. And then a van comes to take the horse to the lovely retirement horse facility where it'll be green pastures always and happiness. And it just turns out that in order to get the horse to this wonderful place, there's mentioning on the sides because they just happen to use that for transportation is all. Just for transportation, the glue factory. You know, so, but that's not where he's going.
So what does this have to do with intentional community?
Well, the pigs, they made some sort of document that they painted, I think, on the side of the barn that's like their manifesto or something. And it had a bunch of statements about how they're going to all live this more amazing life now that they don't have the farmer. But what would happen is in the middle of the night, the pigs would modify it. And so then the pigs at some point in time, so like one of the things was four legs good, two legs bad. And then at some point in time, the pigs started to socialize with the other farmers in the area and then would taught themselves how to walk around on their hind feet.
So what does this have to do with intentional community again?
It has to do with changing the rules. It has to do with being able to change the rules as
needs. Well, you mean needs. Being able to be flexible in the moment based on outside data?
And yes, And okay. then that's kind of, but the pigs did it in a bad way.
Right. So what we want is for communities to be able to do it in an above board, transparent way that's beneficial.
There you go. There you go. There you go.
Okay.
All right.
Cool.
So we've talked about all of the things and then some that were accidentally lost when we recorded a podcast 6 weeks ago.
Good.
And now what I want to do is to move on to the place where I posted and said, hey, who's got questions for Diana Leif Christian?
Okay.
And so question number one, ask her about the letter in The Activist slamming the eco-village she lives in, Earthhaven.
Okay. I haven't yet emailed or called The Activist to find out what it said in that letter, and I will. But in the meantime, I'm going to pretend that I know what it said. I'm going to say to the reader, the poster of on the permies.com who said that, who asked that, did the letter say, boy, they sure don't have it together over in Earthhaven. This and this and this and this is dysfunctional and ineffective and people are unhappy, la, 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 la. And I would say that if that letter came in to the permaculture activist some years ago, the letter would be absolutely accurate. The person who wrote it, maybe that's somebody who lives here or did live here or visited here, I would say, yeah, they're right. That is what's going on. Dysfunction, lack of good project management, all kinds of things are going on that aren't so good. However, that's the good news, which is that person who wrote that letter was right on. The good news is that, boy, have we got our act together. We are in the process of doing major course correction. We're changing our culture. We're changing our meeting dynamics. We have changed our governance and decision-making method radically, radically. I'm going to say it a third time, radically. Anymore, there cannot be any tyranny of the minority anymore. No, absolutely not. None. Nada. Nicht. Nimmer. Zilch. And lastly, we are changing ourselves legally and financially to be more effective and transparent and workable in the world. We have wonderful young people who want to join us and a few older people who want to join us who are waiting until we're having our membership process open up again once we've finished our legal and financial restructuring. So I, as the world's greatest critic of dysfunctional communities, am feeling so hopeful and so filled with joy and promise about this wonderful place, Earthhaven. So I would say, depends on how long ago that letter occurred, you know, and when in time the person who wrote the letter was taking a snapshot of Earthhaven. So I hope that's a helpful answer.
We should say that when we say the activist, which is what's in the question that we know.
The Permaculture Activist Magazine.
The Permaculture Activist Magazine, yes.
Uh-huh.
And the two guys that are basically the heart and soul behind the Permaculture Activist actually used to live in Earthhaven, didn't they?
That's right. Peter Bain, the publisher, is one of the founders of Earthhaven. And he's a friend of mine, and I basically adore the guy. And his partner, Keith, is an early member who came to join Peter here, and then they both lived here for a while, both of them together for, oh gosh, maybe 6 or 7 years. And then they left and moved to another state.
I think they're in the Midwest somewhere.
Uh-huh, right. They are living in Bloomington, Indiana, but they are moving to Michigan.
Oh, that's news to me. Okay, all right.
Yeah.
So I have Keith's got a big thing out on Facebook now, and they've got the Permaculture Activist has a website, and I like a lot of the stuff that they put in that magazine. It's a good magazine. I'm glad that they've been filling it with great stuff. All right, you ready for the next question?
Yes, sir.
Okay, this is DJ. So the first question was by Tim Canton, and now DJ Wells looks like four questions, one after another. The first one is...
Why don't you tell me all four because they might be related, and then I can answer them in a more effective way
if
I know what they all are.
All right, then.
Thank you.
I have her book and have been studying community building. Lately, I've come across the concept called collective impact that seems to be a new buzzword on the subject.
Uh-huh.
Can she speak on that?
Okay, what's the next question? Because I can, and I will, but what's the next one?
Can she also address the idea of co-housing and community building, one of the main features I see about co-housing is that community is built among the members before the infrastructure to live in community is planned. How successful is the field of dreams approach to building a community eco-village or whatever work?
Okay, I got it.
No, she's got a little bit more on this one.
Okay.
Just build it and they will come? Does she know of instances of this, i.e. the Disney-led residential village? All right, so that's the second question.
I don't know what that Disney-led residential village means, but I know all the rest of it, so I will be able to answer that one. What's the third
one? Number three. Another model of community I've studied is the kibbutz.
Kibbutz.
Right. And the moshav?
A moshav. It's a collective farm in Israel, and a kibbutz is a income-sharing commune in Israel.
The latter was developed to integrate more individual ownership into the communal kibbutz model. What has she found in her experience about the balance between community slash individual, especially regarding to poverty or property, especially regarding to property and assets?
Okay, I got an answer for that. What's the last one?
And the last question is, has she seen a progression regarding building communities that might parallel business building, i.e.
Yes.
often a strong personality, entrepreneurial type gets it going, then a more bureaucratic management type organization takes over to run it? Do the business paradigms apply well to community building, or is it too much of a different sort altogether with different growth patterns and dynamics?
Okay, great. Let's go.
What can be learned from business to apply to the process? Okay. There, I'm done.
Okay. First question, collective impact. What that is a phrase used in business that means that in various different organizations that have related values or interests in any given geographical region or perhaps across several regions, you've got a larger overarching organization with representatives that come from these different smaller, more focused organizations to create a kind of a network. So you have a greater impact to help the whole group of folks do what they need to do because you have this network. For example, let's say that you had a place where there was various organic farms. There was a health food store that specialized in organic food. There was a food co-op. There was a food buying co-op. There was a municipality with an agency that tried to get fresh local produce to people in neighborhoods that normally couldn't get access to it because supermarkets had all moved out. And so these are different organizations having to do with food, but at different levels and different scales and different parts of the chain. You know, some are providing food, some are selling food, some are trying to... Oh, and let's say you had an organization in there that was trying to collect food that's not used by restaurants or bakeries or supermarkets and give it away to folks who needed it. So all of these organizations would have a representative that would go to this network organization that might be called Food Security for Nelson County. That's what collective impact means as far as I know what it means. Intentional communities can join overarching networks of intentional communities. One is the Fellowship for Intentional Community in the U.S. Another is the Federation of Egalitarian Communities, which is about income-sharing communities only. And then there's ENA, Ecovillage Network of the Americas. That's a network that I'm involved in. So that's collective impact. Let's go on to co-housing and community building. I'm assuming that this lady means co-housing literally and precisely and not as an alternative word for the phrase intentional community, which means all the different kinds of communities. So I'm assuming she means co-housing literally and specifically. Okay, both things work well. Everybody together planning the community before they ever move into the buildings can work well. People moving into buildings that already exist can work well, as long as there's a membership process and an orientation process. or maybe there's no membership process because it's literally co-housing and they're in the U.S. or Canada where federal fair housing laws apply, and maybe the incoming people don't come from the waiting list but come from right off the street, you might say. If there is an orientation process, this can work well. Yes, I do know of a co-housing community that was built and they will come. It's called Yulupa Co-Housing. It's on Yulupa Avenue in Santa Rosa, California. It is the strangest and most beautiful, weird-looking community you ever did see. It looks like a set from an opera. It looks like one of the alien planet architecture from Star Trek, when you know you beam down to the planet and have this special culture with this special architecture. It looks like a Taos Pueblo place, and it's fabulous looking, and the architect, Michael Black, had a pal who was a developer, and he designed the whole community without input from any potential incoming member, and the developer developed it without input from any potential incoming member, and they called it Build It and You Will Come, and a whole bunch of people really liked how it looked and what it cost and where it was located, and they joined it, and people who may not have liked it, they didn't join it. So they have a bunch of people there who really enjoy this beautiful and amazing architecture, and yes, it can work. What they did have was that Michael's wife, a lady named Alexandra, is a specialist in good process and communication skills, and she taught them governance and decision-making and communication skills, which they needed to know if they were going to go live there in community, and they did learn it, and they do practice it, and they're doing fine. So I hope that is a good answer to the second one. So she mentions kibbutzim and moshavim in Israel, and she's conflating two different ideas. One is individuality and community, which is one issue, and the other is income sharing economic system and independent income economic system. So I'm going to take the second one first. Two kinds of economic systems in intentional communities, not just kibbutzim and moshavim. By the way, that's the plural of those, multiple kibbutzes and multiple moshavim, but really you put ayim on it in Hebrew, so kibbutzim, moshavim. And when they were mostly income sharing, that was back before maybe the 70s, and then various of them chose, because the members made a new decision, to become independent income. There's a whole lot of discussion about this in the kibbutzim movement in Israel. Many people really wish they would still be income sharing. A moshav is a farm. It's a kibbutz, but it specializes in farming. In both cases, the kibbutzim and the moshavim, they get government subsidies big time. And Israel owns all its own land. The country of Israel owns the land inside the borders of the country. Individuals don't until they give it to them. So they've been granted these lands for farming in moshavim and lands for doing whatever they do, and sometimes it's farming in kibbutzim. Okay, so some people who are living in one or the other of these kind of communities say, hey, we really like it that we're independent income now. We each go to the job that we want, and we make the money that we want, and we earn it how we do, and then we come here and we live here. And others say, well, we still are doing income sharing, and that's what we prefer. So I don't have any response one way or another about the kibbutzim and the moshavim in Israel, other than it's a big topic of discussion among people who have strong feelings about it one way or the other. If her question to me is, hey, what do you think about the difference between income-sharing communities and independent income communities? First, I should say, most communities in the U.S. are independent income. That means you earn your money however you do in your job or through your investments, or you have a retirement money or whatever. And maybe you go to work, or maybe you telecommute, or maybe you're retired, or maybe you have a family annuity of some kind. But the point is, whatever way you have money, it's your own business. You spend it how you want. You invest it how you want. You save it how you want. It's your business. All co-housing communities are like that. My community, Earth Haven, is like that. Most communities in the U.S. are like that. An income-sharing community is where the community has people who either work for a community-owned business. They get a room, they get their food, they might get a small stipend. Or they go out to a job and they come home and they put their paycheck into the common pot, and the community owns their paycheck, and then they get something in return like a room and their food and maybe a small stipend. Income-sharing communities are relatively rare, but the ones that are in existence in the U.S. are big and large and famous, like Twin Oaks in Virginia, East Wind in Missouri. A small one, but it's old and has been going on a long time, is Sandhill Farm in Missouri. Then there's Alpha Farm in Deadwood, Oregon. And there's one called Acorn in rural Virginia, not so far from Twin Oaks. It was founded by Twin Oaks. Get it? Oaks, Acorn. And I don't have an opinion too much one way or the other, except that people who want to be in an income-sharing community can, because there are these communities they could join. The benefit of being in one is you don't have to have money to join. You just join. You can be without money at all, and you join. The downside, if you consider it a downside, is that you can't exactly send your child to college or get your child braces or buy that truck. You use the community truck. And when you leave, if you leave, you leave with a shirt on your back. You don't leave with any assets. In an independent income community, you pay money to join, and you may be able to get all or most of your money out later, depending on how the community is structured. And you need to know about that before you join. They should tell you before you join what the answer to that one is. Do I get my money back if I leave? Oh, please find that out before you ever join. Okay, I think both are just fine, and it depends on what people want. Okay, let's talk about strong personality, entrepreneur, business paradigms, management. One, most communities are started by people who have strong entrepreneurial skills, because that's a set of skills that helps people start a community. That is to say, the person is not risk-averse. They're willing to take a risk. That is to say, they're able to take a vision, see it, imagine it. It hasn't happened yet, but they can see it in their mind, and they're persuasive enough to persuade others to see it too and help them manifest it, and then they do. And that's a certain kind of personality. And I think that's you, Paul, and then that's various different community founders. And then there is the need to do ongoing management. It's extremely important to do effective project management. Some people who are the entrepreneurial kind of folks who start communities are also very good at effective project management. Others are not good at it, but they know that it's needed. Because if they had the ability to start a community, which requires thinking financially and legally and in terms of agreement and in terms of social contracts and in terms of land and financing and site design. This is a multidimensional kind of thing they've created, and if they're capable of thinking like that, they damn well know you need good project management. Some people who live in community do not understand that you need good project management, and they fight against it, saying, we aren't bean counters, we're trying to change the world. And then I come along and say, you need to count your beans while you're changing the world, so please count them, and then don't make it what you're about, just make it a tool. Yes, you've got management in place, that's great, you need it, and, you know, enjoy your life as well. Okay, I do not see being business-like, but not being a business, but being business-like and doing good management, you know, paying your bills, paying the county property taxes if you have them, which you probably will have, paying for liability insurance, I highly recommend that, and dotting your I's and crossing your T's regarding whatever legal entity or entities, plural, that you have with the Secretary of State of the state that you're in or the province that you're in. It's like, yeah, you got to do that stuff. Yes, you absolutely have to do that stuff. Here, I'll say it a third time. Do that stuff. Do not fight against those who point out to you that you have to do that stuff. Otherwise, you're just creating disharmony and you're eroding the community's ability to function well. Okay, so I don't see that being business-like and having good project management hurts a community, but I see that not doing it hurts a community. So I hope I have answered this lady's questions.
Oh, yeah. I'm not sure if DJ is a lady or not.
Oh, I thought you said she. Okay.
Did I say she? Oh, maybe it was me then. Oh, okay.
But you know what? I apologize to DJ, not knowing which gender he or she may be. But in any case, I hope this answers your questions, DJ.
So the next question comes from John Saltveit. He is one of the staff at Permies.com.
Uh-huh.
He says, I would be interested in seeing how she has seen successful models of garden areas divided up between group areas and individual/family areas in community, and dividing up the work too.
Yeah, that's a way to do it. It's how we do it here at Earth Haven. we have 13 neighborhoods at Earth Haven. One is not developed at all, so it's just still forest. And others are a little bit developed, like with one house. Others have a whole complex of huts or houses or multiple family residences. They almost all, but not all, but almost all have a shared community garden area per neighborhood. Not all neighborhoods, but most. And everybody has their own home site where they make their own garden or not, as they wish. When they work on their own garden and their own home site, that's their own time and their own dime, you might say. When they work in the shared community garden of their neighborhood, they and their neighbors work out any kind of labor agreements that they might have together as a neighborhood. People here at Earth Haven are free to apply to lease agricultural land to run some kind of pasturage with livestock or fruit tree orchard or market garden or CSA farm or any kind of gardening thing, as long as it provides food of one kind or another, specifically here for us and our immediate neighbors, as well as maybe the farmer's market. And so then they can lease land from Earth Haven. There are low lease fees and high organic agricultural standards, and that's what we do here. Let's take some other community somewhere where you have a community garden area where we, the whole community, together grow a whole bunch of our own food. And we have hours that we are either required to or that we can choose to work in the garden. Generally, people in the community organize which tasks need to be done in which seasons, with experienced gardeners managing it and telling the rest of us who may not be experienced gardeners, here, this is what you're going to be doing today, setting those potato starts over in that field. Thank you very much. And here, would you please clean these tools? And here, would you please gather these eggs? In other words, the labor is generally divvied up. Quite often, the people working in these places are both community members and work exchangers, or sometimes it's only just work exchangers. Different communities organize this all different ways. Who gets to decide how they organize it? Well, the people in the community themselves decide.
This podcast is continued in part 3.